Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Helping you wake up, remembering this is our Father's world. This is Mornings with Carmen LaBurge on Faith Radio.
Well, good morning. It is September the 11th, and so I'm just going to invite us to allow our minds to return to that particular morning 19 years ago. Remember what you felt. Remember how your heart sank when you saw the video the first time. Remember how your fear rose when the second plane hit the second World Trade Center tower, and we knew that we were under attack. Remember how your mind raced to make sense of it all. Remember how you tried to call everyone you knew who was in New York City, and then every plane in the country or around the world destined for the United States was grounded. Remember how your mind searched to find a cause or a culprit? Remember who you wanted to be with? Remember who you called first? Remember who called you? We have a tendency to want to race beyond the horror and remember that we know who we can blame it on, or remember things that are not quite as bad as it actually felt in the moment. Lament is important, and lament is important today. And so lament again today, and never forget. Most people today will not even pause to consider this date in history, nor the day, nor the loss, but there are literally thousands of families right now here and around the world who suffered such great losses 19 years ago today, such great trauma, that they're reliving it again this morning in ways that most of us will not. And so let's be mindful of them today. Let's pray for them today. Thousands more went and sent their sons and daughters into the war on terror, first to Afghanistan and then to Iraq 19 years ago. And although our drawdowns continue, there are U.S. military personnel still on the ground in both of those countries as we speak. 19 years. September 11th. Never forget. In Isaiah chapter 2, the Lord reveals, "In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, 'Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths.' The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations, and he will settle the disputes of the peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore." So as we remember the reality of September 11th, let us also remember the vision that God sets before us of a future in which one day we will live at perfect peace with God and through God at perfect peace with one another. So even as we remember the horror and the fear, let us also be the people who publicly remember to one another and to the world the hope of a kingdom where war is no more. Matt Hawkins is up next. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
Joining me now, Matthew Hawkins. You can find him on Twitter at MTHawk. You can also find him at MatthewTHawkins.com. Matt, let's talk about, first of all, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to be back.
Thank you. Good to have you. Let's talk about the efforts that the Trump administration has been making to really bring a change to foster care and the foster care system in this country. It's a system that's been in crisis for years, and I'm just not sure that there are a lot of people talking about this particular very, very important conversation that I view as a part of the larger pro-life conversation in the country.
Yeah, we have some good news to talk about on the foster care front. As a little bit of background, I like to highlight adoption and foster care as one of those pretty clear territories where we believe that both the government and the church have responsibilities, different responsibilities for different reasons, but it is a territory over which we Christians agree that government has a rightful position to have a say in adoption and foster care policy, because they are responsible for making sure that minor children who are abandoned or whose parents are can't parent them at the time are having issues. And so we recognize that the state has responsibility for child safety in those kinds of contexts, and to make sure that there's oversight of adoption processes. We also recognize that we as Christians have obligations through the local church and individually to love orphans. And we're supposed to support families who are in foster care situations and come alongside them. And not only that, but families who engage in foster care or adoption, the church has a responsibility and some pretty big opportunities to support those families, even among us, who don't necessarily directly participate in the foster care system. And so this is the backdrop for what appears to be some significant progress at Health and Human Services, the U.S. Health and Human Services Department, led by Lynn Johnson. She's Assistant Secretary of Administration for Children and Families over there. And World Magazine, my friend J.C. Derrick, is reporting that there's been some significant progress. An executive agency like HHS can't mandate a lot of things, but they do bring resources to the table, and they do play a collaborative and convening role, and they do issue rules and regulations at the federal level. So they can have a lot of influence on the foster care system. And what appears to have happened is Johnson launched an all-in foster adoption challenge last year. Their team met with all 50 governors, which is not a small feat. And foster care over the last couple years have seen basically record numbers of foster care adoptions over two decades. So typically, adoptions out of foster care total around 50,000 a year, but the last 2 years saw 63,000 and 66,000 adoptions, which is a pretty good uptick. And we need that kind of engagement to continue, because I think there's something like, it was like close to 400,000 children in adoption or in foster care situations, and a lot of them will age out of the program at age 18. Which, if they don't have a home, a place to call home, and a family to call home, that leaves them at risk for all sorts of not great outcomes during their adulthood. So foster care is someplace we can lean in.
So I want to celebrate one of those, right? So if you are listening right now and you know the name of a child who has been adopted into a forever family, in the last year or so, not just as a part of the all-in foster adoption challenge that the Department of Health and Human Services at the federal level has issued to governors and states across the country, but as a part of the way that God tenderizes the human heart and calls families into this. If you know of one of those, I want you to lift them up right now by name So I want to celebrate the adoption of Coda into the LaBerge tribe last year through foster care and adoption in the state of Tennessee. And so it does happen. Real people do it. Real families are transformed by it. It is precious. It is redemptive. And it is something that we as Christians who understand what it means to be adopted, like, right, we have a theology of adoption, people. We are adopted into the family of God through Jesus Christ, our Savior and Lord. And so we are a people who understand what it means to become a family and to be adopted into the love of a family, and then actually encouraged in our discipleship within that family of faith. And so let's be encouraging one another to engage in this. Let's certainly be supporting those families whom God specifically calls as forever families for foster care children. And then let's also be mindful that there is something broken if a child ends up in a circumstance where they need to be adopted. And so let's be praying for early intervention in those situations, and for ministries like, for those of you that are in Minnesota, ministries like Together for Good. Just want to lift up Maridel Sandberg and the good work they're doing there to seek to prevent families from deteriorating to the point where a child would need to enter into the foster care system of the government. So let's just be mindful that there's an all-out effort across the board among Christians to engage on this topic. We want to encourage you to not only be informed about it, but engage in it as well. Again, the article that that Matt and I would lift up to you, it's called Fostering Changes. J.C. Derrick is the journalist, and World Magazine is the site where you would find it, world.wng.org. So that's world.worldnewsgroup.org. Matt Hawkins and I will be right back. Just when you think it might be over, just when you think the fight is gone. Continue my conversation now with Matt Hawkins. All right, Matt, the pro-life movement, pro-life legislation, these are in your wheelhouse. This has been the area of policy concern of yours for a long time. Every legislator working on the pro-life front is a cookie cutter, right? They're all exactly the same. They all have exactly the same perspective. No?
Right. So this is a little project of mine. We've talked in the past about casting a new vision for pro-life politics. And one of the things that we have to do to make a process or a strategy better is you have to look backwards and reevaluate where we've come from and why we didn't get some stuff done when there were opportunities to get stuff done. And so in the 115th Congress, the pro-life party, so to speak, the Republicans had control of the House and the Senate and the White House, and yet did not pass any legislation that touched on abortion policy at all. They basically played defense, which is what they would do if they were in the minority. So why is that? Well, it's a complex story, and there's a lot of moving parts to it. But one big reason, I think, is that not all pro-life legislators are created equal. There are at least four different kinds that I've categorized, and I'd love to share that with you this morning.
Yeah, please do.
So number one is the champion. The champion legislator leads efforts to advance pro-life policies. They and their staff are steeped in pro-life apologetics. They message well, and they aren't fearful of media. Bold and competent staff help them advance pro-life interests. And they're prepared for debate and gotcha questions on hostile news shows without destroying their career. There are a number of pro-life champions that exist on Capitol Hill, but they are far too rare and really not well supported. I would guesstimate you have less than 10 that you could count across the 500 members of Congress, over 500.
Give us one. Give us one. Like maybe the easiest to identify so that we can say, okay, I can put a mental hook in that.
Yeah, yeah.
I know what he means when he says a champion.
Yeah. So, folks. She's out of the House right now. But Diane Black, Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, all those folks can go toe to toe on in the media environment, on even as hostile as MSNBC and the like, and still have their career. They won't trip over blindsided comments from attacks in the media environment. And
they've memorized material and they're going out there and parroting it. They really know this is right. Where they live.
And also, of course, Chris Smith from New Jersey, I believe, is chair of the pro-life caucus, and he's top notch as well. So you've got the champion. Number two is what I call the reliable vote. And this is frankly the bulk of the pro-life caucus. You can depend on this member's vote for most pro-life legislation once it reaches the floor. They might even co-sponsor a bill, maybe. But reliable votes they're kind of prone to deficiencies. Their staffers may be indifferent or focused on other governing priorities, or not even personally pro-life, talking about the staffers. The reliable vote can be fearful of media. They're really not steeped in the apologetics in the way that the champions are. Their conscience and their vote might be with us, but they've got competing priorities that often win over. But typically, historically, the reliable vote has been an acceptable standard to get pro-life endorsements. And I think we got to stop settling. We need to transform those reliable votes into champions. I think we ought to require every pro-life candidate, including incumbents, to complete executive training in pro-life apologetics and media. That ought to be number one. My third category of pro-life politician, or especially congressional legislator, is the liability. The liability is a subcategory of the reliable vote, but their messaging is so undisciplined as to be harmful to the pro-life cause. This member isn't self-aware enough to know when they aren't helping. They're zealous and they'll vote for policy, but they often ignore the best of pro-life apologetics and messaging discipline. At 47 years of age, and I'm talking about the pro-life movement, and well over 50 million abortions, unborn babies don't have time for us to mess around with these liability candidates anymore. I think we need to get them professional or get them out of office. And that brings me to my last pro-life legislator. This is the pro-life Democrat. They are an endangered species of Capitol Hill, even more elusive than the champion category. But they do exist, even if they have existed at least up until recent history, even if their votes can be mired in political calculations. But there are enough pro-life Democrats nationwide on which to build something. And I think what we've talked about in the past is the most successful and durable policy reforms, particularly through the legislature, are bipartisan. So I think we really need to – it's worth considering diversifying our movement with pro-life Democrats. Require those candidates to decline donations from the abortion lobby, then fund their campaigns enough to insulate them from abortion dollars competing against them. So that's my four different kinds of pro-life legislators, and that is why – we didn't see any meaningful pro-life legislation come about from the 115th Congress. What do you think?
I love this analysis, and I completely recognize individuals that fall into each category. Like, it helps me have a place to sort of, okay, right. Now that I'm hearing that person saying something out loud, that is a liability person. Like, that person is clearly not helping right. us. Or, wow, that person seems to be running away from the media. I know that they are a reliable pro-life vote, but they clearly are not prepared for the kinds of questions that they're getting, or it's not their passion point, or as you said, they have competing interests. And then it occurs to me that if you live in a solidly red or blue district, or you live in a solidly red or blue state, you actually could be a person who influences the election of a pro-life Democrat somewhere else, or even right. where you live. If you're in a blue district or a blue state, you could actually support a pro-life Democrat somewhere else where a Democrat is going to be elected. Like, right. There's some places where that's just going to hold true. And so anyway, that would be an interesting approach for people in the pro-life movement who maybe live in places where, you know, races are not particularly competitive on this front. You know, you could be supporting candidates who are Democrats, who are pro-life, to be elected where a Democrat is going to be elected anyway. Just an interesting conversation. I love it.
Yeah,
all right. Hey,
nice.
We got to leave it right there. I think this is like really helpful, and it helps us think in categories and it helps us think about how there might be an intentional path forward for the pro-life movement. And we like that kind of stuff. So, Matt Hawkins, thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
You know, it just makes us look more and more forward to the book that it sounds like is forthcoming. Okay. That's all I got on that. Okay. Thanks, man.
Thanks.
We'll be right back. All right. What's going on at Facebook and why should we care? Well, millions of us have Facebook accounts. I have two. I have a personal account and then I have a professional account. If you want to follow me on Facebook, where, you know, you could participate in like Facebook Live events and things like that with me, that would be Reconnect with Carmen. That's my professional Facebook platform. I have a personal account, which, you know, I have to be like real friends with people to connect with them on my like, hey, look at pictures of my chickens page. But those of us in positions like this, we have professional pages. We invite people to follow us on Facebook. It's an easy way to engage with us. But Facebook's not necessarily a great place to engage if you're looking for reliable information about what's happening, let's say, in the political sphere. So Chris Martin is up next. He is not a fan of Facebook. We've talked about that frequently. However, he is an expert in the area of social media. He's from Lifeway Social. He's here next to talk with us about what's going on at Facebook and why we should care. That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
I recently received a note from one frustrated mom who asked this: how do I deal with snarkiness in my teen? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Whether you call it snarkiness or rudeness or whatever, it's still disrespect. And it should be off limits in your home. If your teen is rolling his eyes when you talk or answering you in a demeaning and selfish way, you need to take action. Because when left alone, disrespect only gets worse. Take time to talk about respect with your children and lay down a few consequences and boundaries. Have a plan for curbing the snarkiness in your home. Disrespect should never be allowed.
Want more parenting help from Mark Gregston? Find encouragement through articles, books, and more at ParentingTodaysTeens.org. Again, ParentingTodaysTeens.org.
Joining me now, Chris Martin from Lifeway Social. He's a big fan of Facebook. No, he's not. But we're going to talk about Facebook today. Chris, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, so if a person were to type Facebook into their Google search bar and they were to hit the news tab, I recognize not everybody will get the same results that I'm getting. But right now, if I do that, I get introducing Facebook Campus, Facebook reinventing itself, sort of returning to its own roots. The Economist today is saying Facebook offers a distorted view of American news. CNET, let's see, here we got one from Vox. Conservative news seems popular on Facebook, but there's a catch. And then all kinds of things related to things that Zuckerberg is saying about Facebook. Okay, so those would be that would be one way of sort of beginning to get a sense of what's going on at Facebook. One of the things that seems to never show up is that the terms of service are different, changing. That people need to pay attention to what goes on at Facebook because they do have a lot of control over us. And then I like what you have posted in terms of why Facebook won't address its internal problems until it's sort of made to do so, until controversy comes. So talk about that. Talk about what motivates a company like Facebook to actually make a change.
I'll give a one-word answer, and then we'll dive deeper into it. what motivates Facebook to change is money, or rather a threat to its financial state. I think one of the, and it's kind of funny, this is becoming my shtick, if you will. But I'm writing a book right now on the social internet, social media, and how our interaction with social media is changing us and revealing who we are and what we're like. And a significant part of the point of the book is not to focus on one particular platform or talk about how to be nice to people on Twitter or how to use discernment on Facebook, though all of that is kind of part of it. It's kind of looking at the more, I wanted to write a book about the social internet that was true in 20 years, not just true based on whatever's going on right now. So I'm focused on a lot larger kind of themes and undercurrents of what's going on and how it's affecting us. And naturally, Facebook is the largest social media platform in the world, even by itself, but then it owns Instagram, which is another one of the largest social media platforms in the world, and certainly one of the most influential, if not the most influential. And so the Facebook suite of platforms, over a third of the world's population use these platforms every day. So it's important to me that we understand how Facebook works, what motivates them, what their values are. We're giving more time to Facebook than we're giving to anything in the world. More time to Facebook than television, more time to Facebook than certainly reading the Bible, more time to Facebook than usually talking to our family or friends. And you may disagree with me or balk at that, but if you have an iPhone and you just look at your screen time feature, beware, you'll be shocked at what you see, but you probably spend more time on Facebook or your preferred social media platform than you even realize. And so it's very important to me that we I forget the author who used this term, that we be what are called, quote, great noticers. I want us all to be great noticers. And there's a man, and I am blanking on his name. He when the clock was invented, he was kind of a thinker, philosopher type. And he looked at the clock and he said, you know, this doesn't just tell us what the time is. It's doing more than that. The clock has decided how we structure our days. We've built our lives around the clock. We invented the clock, and theoretically the clock should be serving us. But now we're kind of serving the clock. We've built our day around this device that was intended to tell us how soon the sun will be going down or how long it's been since the sun has come up and give us a gauge of where we are in our day. And now we're kind of building our lives around this. So this guy looked beyond, if you just looked at a clock and said, oh, it tells us the time. That would be the simple way of understanding a clock. He said, well, what's the clock doing to us? How is it changing how we think about our day? How is it changing how we structure our time and how we spend our time? That mentality, I want us to apply that to social media broadly and Facebook specifically, because Facebook's primary motivation is to make money. There's nothing wrong with that. But we have to understand that if Facebook's primary motivation is to make as much money as possible, decisions they make are going to reflect that value. So when Facebook makes a decision about a privacy policy, whether or not your data could be shared with a particular advertiser or whether or not you maybe be able to serve certain ads that you may find reprehensible or offensive, they're going to make decisions that generate them more money rather than make decisions that benefit their users. And sometimes, often, those two things conflict. And so the privacy is an example. They're going to make decisions that make our data as available as possible to an advertiser rather than make decisions to protect our data from advertisers that could use it to manipulate us in various ways, whether it's just to manipulate us to purchase those shoes we've been looking at, or to manipulate us to vote in a certain way or not vote at all. And so I think it's important for us. It's really easy for us to log on to Facebook or pick your social media platform, but Facebook's who we're picking on, because I think First of all, let me stop here. Why pick on Facebook? Because more than any other social media platform, they routinely make decisions that benefit their bottom line to the detriment of their users. Twitter hasn't done that quite as much. LinkedIn hasn't done that quite as much. A lot of these other platforms make decisions that negatively affect their bottom line because they want to positively impact their users. And Facebook tends to make decisions that make them more money but negatively impact their users, and in hopes of their users not knowing, you and I just not being aware that our data is being shared with these different organizations. And then when they get caught, they say, oh, oops, we messed up. Sorry, let us fix that. Trust us, we'll fix it. And then they say they fix it. That makes the PR problem go away. But then you and I, Carmen, we don't have the ability to know if they fixed it. All we have to do is wait for the next controversy to happen and see if they actually did. It's not like you or I can dig into Facebook's code and say, oh, okay, I can confirm they stopped sharing that data. They just apologize. We trust that they fixed the problem that was accidentally sharing our data with all these different organizations. And then we move on because we have 100 other things to be mad about today. And so Facebook routinely makes decisions that support its bottom line to the detriment of its users. And I think it's important for us to be aware of that, because the decisions it's making are affecting how we relate to people, how we think, how we consume news. And it's really kind of affecting our minds and our way of being more than we realize. And it's important to me that we recognize that.
All right, if you guys want to follow Chris's thinking on this, he's actually in the midst of a series of posts about Facebook on his Substack. So that is called termsofservice.substack.com. That's where you can find Chris Martin's amplified thoughts, the topic of a series of conversations he's having there on Facebook. All right, Chris, you and I have to take a very brief break. When we come back, I don't know, we might pivot to something new. I don't know. I'll decide during the break. We'll be right back.
Cool.
Where were you when the world stopped turning on that September day? Were you in the...
Continue my conversation with Chris Martin from Lifeway Social. All right, Chris, this is completely out of left field and the blue, possibly. But I read a piece that Russell Moore has posted at thegospelcoalition.org. Why unhealthy people crave controversy. And it made me think about the ways in which people seem to repost and platform hateful rage or even gossipy nonsense, mean-spirited things on their social media platforms more often than they will, you know, like, repost, retweet, or whatever it is that you do on Facebook, share things that are positive and glorifying to God and edifying to people. So I guess I'm just wondering if you see what I see and why you think it is that we have a tendency, even as Christians, to allow ourselves to engage in rage on social media and platform and promote and share and retweet really horrible things.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked this question, because I think it's a huge issue, and I think you're really onto something. Also in my book, and I promise I'm not plugging my book, you can't even get anywhere yet. It doesn't even have a title yet, but it's just on the top of my mind because I'm constantly writing it in all my free time right now. I focus a lot on this. And Carmen, the simple answer is this. The reason people are always mad online and always – the reason people love rage as much as it seems like they're – it's like people love to be mad. And the question is why? Why would you – why are people doing that? Why are they feeling that way? Why do they seem to be promoting rage? And I think it comes down to a simple principle. Being mad and or being a jerk online is the most effective way to get attention. And the social internet, the primary currency on the social internet is attention. Financially poor people can be incredibly rich online because they get tons of attention. Attention is the currency of the social internet. And the way you get attention is not by being calm and moderated and self-disciplined. The way you get attention is by being outrageous in various ways, often being outraged. There's a great book called 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts Right Now by Jerron Lanier. It's very small. It's like 130 pages. Jerron Lanier is an original Silicon Valley guy. He invented like the first virtual reality machine, and is friends with all kinds of people who are in the social media space. And he recognizes – he has no online presence or anything like that. He recognizes the negative effects of social media. And he really, his book and his writings were the ones that convinced me that social media is not a neutral tool. Social media is actually has a negative bent. I used to think social media was a neutral tool that we just messed up because of our sin. And I do think that's true to some extent, but I think he has convinced me that no, social media is designed to bring out the worst in us. And part of that is attention is the primary currency of the social internet. And the primary way you accrue that currency is by being a jerk and being outraged and spreading negativity because, and I think this is in our sin, we're more interested in negative stuff than we are in positive stuff. As a headline writer, so like I work in blogs and stuff like that, and I've helped run a number of blogs over the years. You would be sad to know that blog posts or blog titles like three of the biggest mistakes pastors have ever made gets way more attention than three of the best things pastors ever do, because people just want to know the bad stuff more than they want to know the good stuff. It gets the most attention. Then for sites that generate revenue based on attention, that does lead to actual offline currency. So the platforms we use, the algorithms that we are governed by when we're posting content, are more likely to snowball rage, angry content than they are positive content.
The connection between sort of online currency of attention leading to real currency. What you're talking about there is the way people monetize their presence on social media. Yes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that for a lot of people, that is a total like mysterious area of all of this. I found out recently that the only reason that this one individual who's in Christian ministry, I mean, you know, the only time that he ever like retweets someone or makes a mention of them on Instagram or certainly would ever go so far as to like promote them on his Facebook page is because he's getting paid to do so. And I'm like, just like, I'm so grossed out by that. Like, anyway. So, yeah, I didn't know. I just admit to you, I was naive to that. I didn't really know that was going on. Apparently it is. And now I'm suspicious of many of my friends. Okay. So, which is probably not a good way to be either. Chris, you, I think you're helping us see what other people would prefer we not see.
Yes.
In terms of the way social media platforms are really not there as service providers to help us cultivate relationships.
100%. They are there. let me give one comment before we go, because I know we're up against time. The service they provide to us to connect us is the small price they are paying us in order to collect our data, which is then what they make money off of. So yeah, it's social media platforms are data harvesting companies as much as they are connection companies. And I think it's important that we recognize that.
Always so helpful. If you guys want to find Chris, go sign up for his newsletter, termsofservice.substack.com. Chris Martin, you can also find him at Lifeway Social. Lifeway Social Voices. Hey, Chris, thanks so much, as always.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. We'll be right back. Okay, I have a story to tell you now that is relevant to nothing we have discussed thus far. But in my studio every morning, my dog is here, and her name is Sassy. And while she's in here, I call her studio dog. She is an excellent companion in the studio. She has this pillow that she immediately, when we come into the studio and I close the doors that actually make this like a silent environment, she hops up on her little pillow. She literally does not move the entire time I'm on air. Well, yesterday there were two interlopers, the other dogs who happened to also be ours, Ann and Dan. And the two interlopers bounded their way into the studio yesterday afternoon while I was working on some other things. And let's just say that they have contaminated her pillow with, I mean, you know, they didn't do anything other than they got up on the pillow. It obviously smells like them, and she's disgusted. Like, today, she is disgusted with me and the fact that obviously there were interlopers sitting on her pillow. So I share that with you because it is a window into my morning where I have been subjected to the last hour to the disdain of a dog. She has been, she's been disdaining me the entire hour. So if you're feeling anything other than disdain for me this morning, I appreciate it. I don't know how your day is unfolding, but that's the way mine has started. It's a joy to be able to engage in conversation with one another, to survey the landscape that's happening in our own communities, in our country, and around the world, and together to bring the mind of Christ to bear. That is my goal each and every day. I hope that you find it edifying. And if so, I would love to not only hear from you, but also have you share what we're doing with someone else. That's the way you actually become like a missionary of this ministry. And so later today, Paul's going to post the show at myfaithradio.com. If you found it edifying and you've thought of somebody that would benefit, be blessed by what we've talked about, go ahead and share today's show with someone new. Become a radio missionary of what we're doing here, or a podcast missionary for those of you who are listening, streaming online at myfaithradio.com or via the Faith Radio app. You are, you're a part of how God is advancing the gospel to more and more people through this ministry. All right. We got another hour of Mornings with Carmen up next. We'll be right back. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.